made possible by listeners like us.
I'm Emery.
I'm Ethan.
I'm Ella.
I'm Seth.
We're the Scotchulous Kids, but most people call us the Scotchuli. We hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. Lots of graduating students are missing out on the big ceremonies marking their achievement. Today, we'll hear Justice Clarence Thomas talk about perspective and faith.
That's ahead today on Legal Docket. Also, the Monday Money Beat. Today, our financial analyst talks with us about the latest unemployment and deficit numbers and explains that moment last week when the price of Texas oil went negative. Plus, the World Radio History Book today, an American military mission to the island of the Dominican Republic, and the lure and fallacy of atheism.
It's Monday, April 27th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Up next, Kent Covington has today's news.
Most dine-in restaurants can reopen for business today in Georgia under certain conditions. Republican Governor Brian Kemp's executive order makes clear that it is not back to business as usual. Among the rules, workers must wear masks, parties of more than six people are prohibited, and parties must be separated by 6 feet. Georgia reopened gyms, nail salons, and other businesses on Friday, also under strict conditions. But Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, a Democrat, says it's still too early to reopen.
To open up our state today is irresponsible. Simply because we have hospital beds and we aren't at capacity doesn't mean that we need to work to fill them up.
But Georgia resident and former GOP presidential candidate Herman Cain told Fox News that business operators are largely acting responsibly, reopening only if they can do so safely.
Just because you have the right to do something doesn't mean it's the right thing to do.
Yes.
And people are showing that they've got enough common sense to figure out the right thing to do.
Bowling alleys and movie theaters are also allowed to conditionally reopen, but most major theater chains say they have no plans to reopen right now. Multiple other states are also taking steps toward reopening. Nebraska's Republican Governor Pete Ricketts announced Friday night.
Some more restrictions we're releasing today, for example, to allow for worship services, weddings and funerals under certain circumstances, you know, doing that physical distancing, the 6 foot thing, to do that statewide. We're also for about half our public health districts going to be allowing restaurants to be able to have dine in customers.
Nebraska restaurants will have to follow rules similar to those in Georgia. The Paycheck Protection Program is back online today. Banks started processing about 700,000 finished applications yesterday that were on hold since the program ran out of cash more than a week ago. Lenders are set to start taking new applications today, but it's not clear how much money will be left after processing the already pending applications. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said he's not worried about the fast pace.
So the first round impacted about 30 million workers. I think this round will be about the same. That'll be close to 50% of the private workforce. So I actually hope we run out of money quickly so we can get the money into the workers' pockets.
The latest aid package, which President Trump signed into law on Friday, adds more than $300 billion for small businesses. It's designed to help businesses keep the lights on and keep workers on the payroll until the worst of the COVID-19 crisis passes. The top Navy officer has reportedly recommended reinstating Captain Brett Crozier after an investigation into his firing. The Associated Press cites multiple officials and reporting that Admiral Mike Gilday wants Crozier back at the helm of the USS Theodore Roosevelt aircraft carrier. Crozier penned a letter stating concerns that the Navy had not done enough to protect the crew of his ship from the coronavirus. He was stripped of his command a short time later. Then, Acting Navy Secretary Thomas Modley, who has since resigned, said Crozier violated the chain of command by distributing that letter too widely. Hundreds of crewmen from the Roosevelt have contracted the virus, and one sailor died. Gilday's recommendation is on the desk of Defense Secretary Mark Esper for final approval. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is back on the job today, 2 weeks after he left a London hospital following a bout with COVID-19. Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has been standing in for the Prime Minister. He said Sunday that Johnson was right to take time off to fully recover.
as you can imagine, with the Prime Minister, he's raring to go. And I spoke to him, I've spoken to him every day this week. We've made sure that he's abreast of everything that's going on.
Johnson reclaims the reins as his government faces growing criticism over the deaths and disruption the virus has caused. Britain has recorded more than 20,000 deaths among people hospitalized with COVID-19. Thousands more are thought to have died in nursing homes. A top South Korean official said Sunday that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is alive and well. That comes amid numerous reports that Kim is gravely ill following a recent heart surgery. A report over the weekend from a Japanese magazine even claimed that Kim is now in a vegetative state. North Korea's state media have been silent about the speculation on Kim's health, but Reuters reported that China has dispatched a high-level delegation to advise North Korea. Some experts caution that rumors have abounded for years about Kim and his predecessors, and most turned out to be false. But if Kim is no longer able to lead, his influential sister, Kim Yo-jong, could become the country's first female leader. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, Justice Clarence Thomas delivers a dedication speech at Hillsdale College. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Monday morning, and we are back at it for another week of The World and Everything in It. Today is the 27th of April, 2020. Good morning to you. I'm Nick Eichner.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Today we have a special legal docket featuring a talk by Justice Clarence Thomas. He's not a justice who speaks up much during oral arguments at the Supreme Court. It's not that he's shy. He just has a different philosophy about the purpose of oral arguments than do the other justices.
Well, I'd agree with that. Slow to speak, quick to listen. Probably a lesson in there somewhere for those of us who are talkers.
No doubt.
But before we get to that speech, a brief note about what the justices are up to these days. We do expect opinions today, and tomorrow we will bring you a synopsis of those. And 1 week from today, the justices are scheduled to hold oral arguments by way of teleconference. And Mary, I know you'll have analysis on some of those the following Monday, and again, for several Mondays until we are all caught up.
Sounds good, and it'll be good to finish those up. And now, before that speech by Justice Thomas, we know a lot of students expected to walk across a platform and receive a diploma or a college degree over the next few weeks. Those ceremonies have been canceled, much to the disappointment of so many, including myself. My son graduates with honors from college in just a few days. I was so looking forward to celebrating that with him, but it's not to be, at least not in the usual way.
Well, congratulations to good Clayton Reichard, and regrettable timing for him and for you and Joe and the rest of the family. And, of course, you remember my complaining last year, right, about the three sons' graduations all about the same time, law school, college, and high school. But you don't, you'll note, you don't hear those complaints from me, not anymore, anyway. So in honor of all of the graduates, not a commencement speech, but instead a dedication speech.
And that still seems so right as we dedicate our young adults to their future lives. Hillsdale College opened a new chapel on its campus last year, and Justice Thomas affirmed that achievement as a public declaration that faith and reason are mutually reinforcing. We start with his reflection on the meaning of sacred spaces. Let's listen to these excerpts from October 3rd, 2019.
This is a very special occasion, 175th anniversary of Hillsdale and the dedication of this beautiful chapel. The chapel's enduring beauty highlights the transcendence, the sovereignty, and the grace of God. The primary purpose of a chapel is to provide a place where man can enter the presence of God. For as Elijah learned on Mount Horeb, God so often comes to us, not in the storms, not in the earthquakes or fires of life, but in stillness, in a gentle whisper. Accordingly, men and women have long sought respite from the noise and commotion of life, daily life, where they can be still and know that He is God. where they can seek an inner calm and a transcendent peace. Beautiful chapels such as this one provide that sacred space for stillness, a place for an encounter with the divine. Chapels also provide a space for other important activities that take place on a more regular basis. For example, worship services will be held in this chapel. If our highest purpose is to glorify God, what better resource to provide on a college campus than a chapel that allows students, faculty, administrators, staff, and visitors to gather together for worship and prayer. This chapel also will serve as a setting for ceremonies and liturgical concerts, allowing all who gather here to learn together and celebrate before God. And the chapel will be used regularly for personal prayers of reflection, meditation, confession, repentance, forgiveness, and reconciliation. When life is difficult and seems pointless, we need a safe haven where we can escape from the storm and find solace. Chapels provide that setting. They invite us to draw near to God and to elevate our thoughts, to seek His wisdom, to lay down our burdens at the foot of the cross, and to find that peace that surpasses all understanding. This calls to mind Hannah, the mother of the prophet Samuel. When she came to the tabernacle to pray, she was barren but longed for a child. The Bible describes her as deeply depressed. But Hannah poured out her soul before the Lord at the tabernacle. And after a time of prayer and speaking with the priests, her face was no longer sad. She came to the tabernacle in anguish. She left at peace. Like Hannah, my life was changed through prayer at a place of worship. In my early adult years, I was self-reliant, so I thought, and gave little attention to God. But not long after I joined President Reagan's administration, I was in the midst of one of the darkest periods of my life. Life seemed hopeless and felt like I had nowhere to turn. In the midst of this hardship and grief, God drew me back to the church, and He used a church building to do it. Within those walls, I was able to elevate my thoughts beyond my circumstances and self-absorption, and set my mind on things that are above, not on things that are on earth, as St. Paul wrote in the letter to the Colossians. The college years require young people to make decisions that will affect the rest of their lives. They are exposed to new ideas, new relationships, new distractions, and new temptations. They need a place where they can go to be relieved of their troubles and get their bearing, as so much comes at them so fast. In short, Hillsdale College has recognized the importance of equipping students, not only intellectually, but also spiritually, for the many challenges of life in college and beyond. The construction of a college chapel, in particular, is a public declaration that faith and reason are mutually reinforcing. John Adams wrote, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Without the guardrails supplied by religious conviction, popular sovereignty can devolve into mob rule, unmoored from any conception of objective truth." As I think about our political culture today, I am reminded of Ronald Reagan's warning that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children in the bloodstream. The only way they can inherit the freedom we have known is if we fight for it, protect it, defend it, and then hand it to them to do the same. Faith in God, more than anything else, fuels the strength of character and self-discipline necessary to ably discharge that responsibility. Hillsdale College was founded on the understanding that the battle to preserve and promote freedom in our country will be waged in the hearts and minds of the people. Rather than shrinking from the battle, Hillsdale is rising to the occasion by investing in the intellectual and spiritual development of its students so they can provide God-honoring leadership in our country. May God bless each of you, and may God bless this wonderful country. Thank you.
That's Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas dedicating a new chapel at Hillsdale College last fall. To hear his full speech, look for the link in today's transcript. Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, the Monday Money Beat.
Well, it was a down week on Wall Street, but only slightly. And those wild swings up and down that we've kind of gotten used to were still present, but, and this analysis is a sign of the times too, but the swings were in the hundreds of points instead of in the thousands of points. So in that sense, a little bit of stability in the capital markets. Well, it's time now to turn, as we have been doing during this economic crisis, to financial analyst and advisor David Bahnsen. He's on the line now for our weekly conversation. David, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Well, let's talk from the top. Let's begin with jobless claims. We've been talking about that week by week. The number is, I never thought I would hear myself say this, the number is down to 4.4 million this week. Terrible number, but it's going the right direction. What do you say?
Well, and that's expected. I mean, you assume in a kind of multi-week shutdown that the worst week will be that at the very beginning, because this is measuring initial jobless claims. And so we have gone down by a little over a million per week for the last several weeks. But the aggregate number, which again, you have to remember, it's at least this many, let's call it 26 million now in aggregate. But in reality, that's probably understating the total number of unemployed because of those who either haven't made a claim or couldn't make a claim for whatever reason, or states that maybe are behind in their processing. So the number is really bad, and yet, yeah, certainly on an initial claims basis, declining and will continue to decline now as we get ready for more reopenings.
Let's talk about that kerfuffle in the oil market where the price of West Texas crude for, what, the end of May, delivery the end of May, dropped to a negative level at one point this week. Can you explain all of that?
Yeah, it's the West Texas Intermediate, not the Brent crude. But the key distinction there is this is the oil that is primarily being stored in Cushing, Oklahoma. It's largely the oil that is being produced in Texas and Oklahoma. And it is, I guess, very complicated, yet sure could have been a lot simpler if they could have just simply presented it as storage costs were going higher, not oil prices were going lower, because by talking about negative oil, they actually pretend as if there was someone out there who was buying oil at negative $40, where all we were referring to is the cost that those who in the physical oil market who had no ability to store it were paying to go find storage. The hard part is that unlike the past years, past decades, we have a significant amount of financialization in commodity markets. It's a stock that is supposed to reflect the price of oil, but it isn't doing anything of the sort. And obviously, all these mom-and-pop investors buying this little stock have no intention of taking oil delivery in their house. So the whole thing's a mess, and kind of skewed, I think, the more important conversation, which is that our energy sector is in real trouble. And we're sitting here talking about whether or not we have negative $40 oil or not around the complexity of futures delivery. It was just a silly couple of days.
And of course, the real story there, I guess, beyond the issue of storage is the fact that there's just so little demand right now for oil, right? And it has to do purely with economic activity, does it not?
Well, that's certainly the reason why you have such a glut of supply is that in the month of March, we had a significant increase of supply at the same time that you had a total erosion of demand. But ultimately, there is nobody who sensibly believes that demand is not coming back. We don't know to what level and at what speed, but obviously the world cannot function without oil. And so the demand part will resume as normal economic activity resumes.
Let me move on now, David, to the CBO report, the Congressional Budget Office. There were some economic projections that were interesting. I'd like to get your comment on those. Basically, what the CBO economists predicted is a 12% contraction in the second quarter of economic output. So minus 12 in quarter two, they believe. They project a jobless rate about 14%. Those numbers are just huge. Deficit spending, $3.7 trillion. That almost quadruples where it was at the end of March. Deficit, 18% of gross domestic product. So of the overall production of the economy, the deficit is equal to 18% of it versus in 2019, 4.6%, just to give a sense of context. The highest deficit spending since World War II. Take your pick.
Well, it's interesting. I think in some cases, the numbers are overly optimistic. The federal debt, they're predicting, will equal 101% of GDP by the end of this fiscal year. And I think that that is entirely possible. It could be worse than that. That 106% level around World War II, you know, we've seen it before. And that's sort of the analogy that lawmakers are making, is considering COVID a kind of wartime pandemic. And then when things normalize, naturally, those ratios will get much better. It's important for people to understand when they start using analogies to Europe or Japan, that Japan is running about 260% debt to GDP. Many Western European countries are running, you know, 150 to 220% debt to GDP. So it's brutal levels of indebtedness, but it isn't abnormal right now, sad to say, in the developed world. I've talked on your show already, and I'm going to be talking about it as long as I have to, even post-COVID, that this story is a setup of the story that I think is going to be most important to people in the years ahead. This is the story that paves the way to the central bank's command and control of the economy and the desperate need for a central bank that will sort of use monetary policy to monetize the debt of a country. When you have that degree of government spending as a percentage of your economy, you have what's called a crowded out effect. The private sector, where more productive activity takes place, is diminished by the role of the excessive government spending, and it contracts from productive economic growth. And so they're not flourishing. That's the goal of economics, certainly for myself as a Christian economist.
David Bahnsen, he is a financial analyst and advisor. He's the chief investment officer at the Bahnsen Group. David, thank you. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks so much.
Today is April 27th. You're listening to World Radio, and we are so glad you are. Good morning. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Next up on The World and Everything in It, the World History Book. Today, the fifth anniversary of the first fanless baseball game in Major League history. Plus, 55 years ago, President Lyndon B. Johnson commits troops to the Dominican Republic.
Up first, the governor of New York creates one of the nation's first official state parks. It's a watershed moment. Here is Paul Butler.
Today we begin on the Niagara River. The waterway links two of North America's Great Lakes, Erie and Ontario. The strait is nearly 36 miles long and descends 326 feet between the sister lakes. More than 200 feet of that occurs all at once at Niagara Falls. In the 1860s, a visionary park designer and land planner named Frederick Olmsted begins lobbying New York state officials and businessmen to protect Niagara Falls. He argues for limiting industrial development along the river so that it can be set aside for public enjoyment. It takes 20 years, but in 1883, New York Governor Grover Cleveland signs legislation authorizing eminent domain. Exactly 2 years later, on April 30th, 1885, the new New York governor creates the Niagara Reservation, and in the process, starts one of the first official state parks in the United States.
Getting that close to the American Falls can be exciting. It does wonderful things to hairdos, glasses, and human egos.
The Niagara Reservation is the longest continually operated state park in the nation. The popular geographic feature hosted more than 30 million visitors last year. Next, April 28, 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson addresses the nation.
The United States government has been informed by military authorities in the Dominican Republic that American lives are in danger.
The political tensions on the island had been brewing for years. In 1961, the president of the Dominican Republic had been assassinated. After 2 years of military rule, the U.S. facilitated democratic elections. An educator and historian named Juan Bosch won that election, but was overthrown by the island's military a few months later, and splinter groups began attempting their own political coups.
I have ordered the Secretary of Defense to put the necessary American troops ashore.
Behind the scenes, U.S. intelligence believed Cuba was trying to leverage the situation to install a communist government, leading Johnson to defend the American military presence.
The American nation cannot, must not, and will not permit the establishment of another communist government in the Western Hemisphere.
President Johnson ordered the troop movement when it appeared doubtful that a stable government could be established immediately.
The military operation was at times quite bloody. 40 U.S. servicemen and as many as 3,000 islanders died during the summer of 65. American forces withdrew in the fall after a new election. Juan Bosch ran but lost to Joaquin Balaguer, who had formerly served in the government in the late 50s. He brought stability, and during his 12 years as president, he rebuilt the island nation's infrastructure and schools. But he ruled with an iron fist, imprisoning and sometimes even killing political rivals. And finally, April 29th, 2015.
It's the Orioles en masse, and we welcome you to Camden Yards in Baltimore.
The Chicago White Sox and Baltimore Orioles make Major League Baseball history.
Hi, everybody. I'm Gary Thorne, and welcome. Circumstances all of us wish were different. This ballpark today is going to be empty. For the first time in Major League history, a ball game will be played with no fans in attendance.
The reason for the empty stadium was social unrest in Baltimore. 2 weeks earlier, Freddie Gray died in police custody. Video footage during his arrest showed the 25-year-old African-American man being tossed into the back of a police van. He later died of traumatic spinal injuries that many believe occurred during what's known as a rough ride, when police stop and start suddenly, bouncing the person in the paddy wagon around in the back. After Gray's funeral, some protesters looted and burned cars. The violence intensified, leading the mayor to enforce a curfew and restrict groups in the city.
This preliminary curfew will last for 1 week.
Major League Baseball decides to go ahead with one game between the White Sox and Orioles, but prohibits fans from entering the stadium.
1-1 delivery, you didn't get a hold of that one. It is deep. Well,
Camden Yard isn't completely empty, though, as there are three times the usual number of reporters. Footage of the game is surreal, as player introductions and organ themes echo unheard, and athletes make plays without cheers.
One ball, two strike count. Britton's delivery to him swung on and missed, and the ball game is over.
The Orioles win the game 8-2, but the team's subdued after the victory, as events happening around the stadium weigh heavily on the players. That's this week's World History Book. I'm Paul Butler.
Today is Monday, April 27th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichert. G.K. Chesterton once said that for Christians, their faith says the world has a meaning and direction. Not so atheism. Here's world commentator Janie B. Chaney.
In a satirical epilogue to the Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis imagines his cagey old demon rising to propose a toast after the annual Tempter's College dinner. While commending his host, he complains about the disappointing meal. That is, the poor quality of sinners that comprised it. That municipal authority with graft sauce was barely palatable, much less the lukewarm casserole of adulterers. Goodness me, what's become of the brazen sinners and brawny atheists of yesteryear? Well, if Lewis had been writing 10 years ago, he might have Screwtape smacking his lips over the so-called four horsemen of outspoken atheism. But Christopher Hitchens has passed into eternity, Daniel Dennett into obscurity, Sam Harris is still dreaming about a rational society, and Richard Dawkins is wondering if that dream is DOA. Dawkins has been the scourge of what he understands as traditional religion. Only a few years ago, he applauded Dennett's proposal to separate children from their fundamentalist parents. But lately, he's expressed some doubts whether the loss of Christianity would be an unvarnished good. His latest book observes that, quote, "Whether irrational or not, it does, unfortunately, seem plausible that if somebody sincerely believes God is watching his every move, he might be more likely to be good." Huh. Though he hates to admit it, Dawkins has run smack into the notion of original sin, which Chesterton described as the most verifiable fact of human history. Other atheist agnostics, such as Douglas Murray and Jordan Peterson, are even less sanguine about the basic goodness of humanity. Some atheists see themselves as heroes in the story of mankind's relentless march toward the bright dawn of unbelief. The world is richer, they say. Lifespans are longer. Wars are shorter because, sometime in the mid-18th century, mankind began building an intellectual framework that excluded God. And because humans are fundamentally decent, things can only get better from here. Yes, about that, Dawkins and others seem to be wondering. What if we humans are the bad guys? Or, if only a few of us are really bad, how will the rest of us gin up the moral courage to stop them? Screwtape concluded his toast by looking on the bright side. Half-baked sin is barely palatable, but thank our Father below, unrepentant sinners abound. Their atheism owes nothing to intellectual rigor. It's more a default setting. Rather than reshape outmoded moral barriers, it simply removes them. To their credit, serious atheists are beginning to question whether that's a good thing. They should have questioned sooner. I'm Janie B. Chaney.
Tomorrow, COVID-19 has put a kink in just about every link of the U.S. food supply chain. We'll tell you how that could affect what is available at the grocery store over the next few months. And we'll talk with World's Onize Ohikere about what life is like in Africa right now. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichert. The World and Everything in It comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. Jesus told the fearful, "Don't be afraid, just believe. Go now in grace and peace."